Welcome to Constitution Day 2008 at the Maryland Institute College of Art. This, the fourth annual Constitution Day conference at MICA, is dedicated to the topic of voting rights. On behalf of MICA, I would like to acknowledge those who have helped support this event, including the ACLU of Maryland, Robert C. Giuliano, Maryland General Hospital, and Cho Ben Holbach. This year is a historic election, and a historically tight one. Every vote will count. Be sure to vote. And be sure that you are registered to vote. If possible, help register voters and monitor polling stations on election day. There are several organizations that are recruiting for those tasks, including the Maryland ACLU and the two political campaigns. Students attending school in Maryland have the right to either register to vote in Maryland or request an absentee ballot in your home state by going to your state election board website. In Maryland, the date to register to vote is October 14th, and the deadline to apply for an absentee ballot is October 28th. If you're not from Maryland, check with your home state about absentee ballot application deadlines. Thank you.
Greetings from the ACLU, the mother of all civil liberties organizations, and we believe that voting rights are the mother of all rights. You know, it's been a long 8 years, and we've seen the very fabric of our constitutional democracy frayed by the abuse of rights, including wiretapping without warrants, government-sponsored terrorism, indefinite detention at Guantanamo, and here in Maryland, police state tactics like infiltrating peace organizations. Brought to you primarily by a president that believes he has no limits to his executive power and that he's above the law, and co-sponsored by a Supreme Court that includes nominees that president appointed. So your vote this year is extremely important to make sure this doesn't happen. And only you can protect your vote. So before you leave, you listen up, of course, to everything everybody says, but before you walk out the door, look for the Maryland ACLU volunteers who have this little packet, which is actually a voting rights empowerment card, and it tells you everything you need to know about where, when, and how to vote in Maryland. So take that with you, pass it on to others if you can, get everybody out to vote. Now, tonight's program is designed to educate us, to scare us a little bit, but most of all, to move us to action. And our moderator tonight is none other than a preeminent journalist and radio host, the founder of the Center for Emerging Media, an activist with a huge heart, and my good friend, Mark Steiner.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to be here for the second year in a row doing this. It's an important day, and this actually topic today and the people that we have brought here to talk with us all today is really a very critical matter. We're talking about voting, and many people in 2000 and 2004, when voices were raised about elections that were stolen, they were ignored by the mainstream press, called kooks, not to be taken seriously. A dear friend of mine, Mark Crispin Miller, was one of those people who screamed from the rooftops and was often silenced by not being put on mainstream media to hear what he had to say about what happens in these elections. And this is a very important time. People are being purged around the country and voter rolls. We see people up to shenanigans in Michigan, which we'll talk about tonight, where people who have come from homes that were foreclosed upon and put out are not going to be allowed to vote. And today it was announced the Obama campaign will take Michigan to court to fight that. And there are instances like this and many more around the country. And so the question is, what is our democracy? There's, as we will talk about as well, I mean, there's nothing in the Constitution that gives us the right to vote. We have to keep the right to vote and fight for the right to vote in America. And as someone who grew up here in this state, which was the South, and I went to jail in Maryland and in Mississippi and Alabama to fight for people's right to vote in the early 60s, it's something that's very crucial and something very dear and important to all of us, which is why even if I don't like the men and women who are running, I'm always going to pull that lever, because a lot of my friends went to jail, got beaten, died and were left addled to fight for the right to vote in this country. And so it is something near and dear to me, and so I was very pleased to be here with this really incredible panel to bring this conversation to all of us today. And our panelists are here, Greg Pallas, Jonathan Simon, and Reverend Jackson. And I will introduce them all as they speak. And let me start by introducing a man that Kathleen Harris called Twisted and Maniacal, Greg Pallas. The Guardian calls him the best investigative reporter of our time, a man who's also kept out the establishment press and has broken some of the most important stories we have in the last decades. He's the author of New York Times best-selling books. He's investigating the upcoming threat to the vote this November, and they're launching this week a comic book, a voter guide, with Reverend Jesse Jackson's Operation Rainbow Push called Steal Back Your Vote. And let me introduce to our audience, for our first speaker, before we start our discussion, Greg Pallas.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Mark, Jonathan, Reverend. Okay, you know, 4 years ago, right after the vote, the Reverend Jackson and I wrote a piece which won a journalism award called 1 Million Missing Votes. 1 million missing votes. Because if you go into the official records of something called the U.S. Elections Assistance Commission, established by George Bush. You know what happens when George Bush tells us he's going to assist our elections. But it does have a very interesting fact in here, that 3 million votes were cast and not counted. Whose votes? We first picked up 1 million votes missing. How does this happen? Well, 1.5 million votes, 1,400,000 votes in the last election were what they called spoiled. We had 3 million votes cast and not counted, 1.4 million called spoiled. How do you spoil a vote? You leave it out of the fridge? What does that mean? Okay. No, it means that you know, like the you didn't punch the punch correctly. Your Chad was hung. The touch screen felt you don't know how to touch it anymore. Whatever. Your vote gets spoiled. The question is, whose vote gets spoiled? I worked with some statisticians at the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, and we went into the spoilage dumpster and pulled out the stinky ballots from the white precincts and made a pile. Then we went to the African-American precincts, and we made a pile. Okay? This is actually from the U.S. Civil Rights Commission's report. See the little white square? Those are white spoiled votes. See the big black bar? That's African-American votes. The chance your vote will spoil, the chance your vote will be cast and not counted, if you are African-American, this is the U.S. government report, is 900% higher than if you're a white voter, 500% higher if you're an Anglo voter. Native Americans, like 2,000% higher than if you're pale-faced. That's not small stuff in those swing states in the West. Now, so we know that of the missing ballots in America, at least 1 million were cast by African Americans. You tell me who won that election. Okay, now, 1 million missing black votes. Where are they now? Okay? I'm setting out, and what I'm finding is this. Going through, this is from this Election Assistance Commission, and it says that in the state of Colorado, if you do some reading here, there are that 19.4% of the voters of Colorado have been purged from the voter rolls. 19.4%. I called secretaries of state office and they first denied it, and I said, well, it's in a report, the U.S. government report. Did you give the U.S. government wrong information? In fact, it was done by a secretary of state, a Republican secretary of state in this important swing state of Colorado named Danetta Davidson. And Danetta Davidson, okay, after she purged 1/5 of the voters of Colorado, and by the way, even the Democratic governor didn't know this when I talked to him about it. George Bush made her the head of the Elections Assistance Commission, made her chairwoman of the entire national operation. In fact, he was going to call her purge in general, but Rove said, "That's not, that won't look very, very good. She won't talk to me. No one will talk to me at the Colorado Secretary of State's office about where are the voters. It's happening again, big time." And so I've gotten together with a law professor, a brilliant voting rights lawyer named Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And that's, you should applaud. And go right ahead, please. And Bobby and I are investigating, as he did in 2004 brilliantly, okay? And our view is that if they're going to steal the vote, and that's what we're finding, like Colorado, that's just one of many examples. You can. There's only one thing to do if they're stealing your vote. You steal it back, okay? Except we do it legally. And so we decide to do the most something very, very important in the middle of this most historic election in American history, which is to write a comic book. Steal back your vote, which we are issuing, and you'll get the words of Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Greg Palast, and some great comic artists and information, which will be sponsored by, in Spanish, Voto Latino, in English, by the Rainbow Push Coalition. You'll see the Reverend Jackson's happy face in here. If they steal it, you steal it back. Now, I won't go through all. By the way, Danette, I was just in Washington. I wanted to ask her about something because, as you know, in Indiana, Reverend, we found out, we saw a cute story. 10 nuns were denied the right to vote under the new laws requiring ID. Okay, require. And by the way, this came, the ID law came literally from Karl Rove, who got up one day, said he was at the grocery store, he needed ID to buy his Pampers or cash a check. And really, and they came up with new laws requiring you to have identification, current photo identification. So why not? I'll tell you why not. It's not just 10 nuns. So 10 nuns showed up to vote. They've been voting in the same voting booth, precinct for decades. And they said, "Scram, sister." Because they were all in their 80s and 90s, and their driver's licenses had expired. So they weren't allowed to vote. Now, that little story came out. What did not come out was the big story. That according to Professor Mark Barreto of the University of Washington, who calculated the effects, there were 143,000 other Democrats denied the right to vote this year in Indiana. That's what's coming in November. That's a swing state, because as the Reverend can tell you, Indiana is a suburb of Chicago. Okay, it is a swing state that Obama, by all rights, by demographics, should own. All right, but 143,000 Democrats were told to scram because they didn't have the right ID. Who doesn't have the right ID? The chance, if you are African American, the chance is more than twice as high that 1 in 10 African Americans do not have the ID that satisfy the Indiana voting requirements. The new Indiana voting requirements. Remember, this is the state, it wasn't Mississippi, it was Indiana where the Ku Klux Klan was born. Is that correct? And we're back. Okay, despite the color of one of the candidates, we still have, in the United States of America, an apartheid election system. Okay? So what I'm asking you tonight, because I can't give you the full story tonight, Kennedy and I are going to be issuing a big report very shortly. We're going to be issuing a film. We're going to be on television with this. But most important is I want you to get the comic book, which means if they're going to steal your vote, steal it back. So I want you to go to stealbackyourvote.org, stealbackyourvote.org, or gregpalast.com will link you through, and you'll get the Push Voto Latino Palast Kennedy voter guide with 7 steps to steal it back. And by the way, they are illegal. The Reverend was a bit concerned about tolerating shoplifting of the electoral process. No, we aren't. But it's telling you things like vote early, in person. Don't mail in your ballot. Okay. So we're trying to give you the tool When they take your vote, they take your democracy. We are not in this, by the way. This is a nonpartisan guide, just so you know. We are not in this to save Democratic candidates. We are in this to save something very, very important, which is American democracy. Thank you.
Our next guest, while Greg Palast has been, I think, one of the great and best investigative reporters we have in the United States today, our next guest and speaker is someone who co-founded the Election Defense Alliance, and his work is geared towards exposing those frauds and finding out ways that we can make it work. And the Election Defense Alliance is a national coordinating body of citizen electoral integrity groups, and he's been working on this for a long time. He's a graduate of Harvard College, New York University School of Law, and he's an advocate of something which is really interesting, which we talked about a while back on our show, which is an exit poll-based electoral burglar alarm system to detect computerized vote shifting, dead in 2004. And there are ways to detect things that are being done to us that we're not really aware of, and that he understands and gets into the complexity of all that. And let me introduce you now to Jonathan Simon. You can speak from here, from your seat, wherever you're comfortable, Jonathan.
Thanks, Mark. I don't think Greg scared you guys enough, so I'm gonna pull out the heavy artillery. I consider myself a self-styled election forensics specialist, and they didn't have election forensics specialists a couple of years ago because they didn't need them, and now maybe we're going to get our own TV show or something like that, based on the models that you probably are familiar with. Let me just give you a brief idea of what's happening in American elections, what the American election circus is like, circa 2008. And I'm not talking about the race. I'm talking about the vote counting. We basically have 80% of the votes being counted by two corporations, which are highly partisan, right-wing corporations with making no bones about their partisan proclivities. They're counting them on machines that they design, program, deploy, repair, maintain, and have virtually absolute proprietary control over, such that you cannot find out what's going on in them, the inner workings. It's black box voting. And this is true both of DREs, which are the touchscreen machines that we probably have some familiarity with, where you just touch the screen and then it transmits a vote of some sort. Maybe gives you a receipt, which is useless, maybe doesn't. And it's also true of the op-scan machines, where you actually mark your ballot and then the machine decides what that mark means, or if it wants to add 1,000 more or whatever, and drops your ballot in a box where it will never be recounted. So these are the machines that ES&S and Diebold supply about 80%, and by the way, the other 20% are right-wing partisan corporations as well. So this is what you have, and this is Alice in Wonderland crazy. If you were starting from scratch, you wouldn't have this. And if you're wondering why it's not being reformed, well, one argument is that it's too expensive. You see, HAVA came along, the Help America Vote Act, and basically decreed that these machines would be deployed, sort of. And they were, and it cost about $4 billion. And, of course, we can't spend any more money on American democracy. We spend $2 billion a week or something on Iraqi democracy. Democracy in quotes, but we can't spend 2 weeks worth of Iraq on actually revamping the American voting system. So that's sort of the legislative reform side of my talk. It's rather short. The other part that I was called upon to speak about is the evidence that this is actually happening. Are we just making this up? Are we tinfoil hat conspiracy theorists that we have basically been dismissed lock, stock, and barrel as being such? I am regret to say that no DRE has, as of yet, walked into a DA's office and signed out a confession. But short of that, the evidence we have is pretty damn strong. And in many ways, it's sort of the least interesting part of what we're going to talk about tonight, because it's so open and shut. If you go to the Election Defense Alliance.org website, you will find plenty of it. So I'm not going to give it to you all. It would be mind-numbing and fairly numerical, but you can go and research to your heart's content the stack of evidentiary material. It's not just one isolated piece of evidence. But I'll give you a summary. We had it in 2004. I was the fellow who downloaded the exit polls before they were adjusted to conform to the vote counts. And the only problem was by 3 a.m. I had pretty much figured out that the election was stolen, done my little calculations, a little hand calculator, and saw that the red shift, that's when the vote returns are more right-wing, more Republican than the exit polls or than the expectations based on exit polls, pre-election polling, whatever else. And the red shift was about 2.7 times as great in the battleground states, in the competitive states, than in the non-competitive states. And that was pathognomonic of manipulation. That's called targeting. And so we basically had it and had no idea who to send it to. Because as of 2004, there weren't too many people paying attention to this, unfortunately. And we know what followed. There was no explanation for the huge exit poll discrepancy, unprecedented exit poll discrepancy in 2004, except the claim that Bush voters were for some reason reluctant to respond to pollsters. I actually provided the name for that crazy hypothesis, called it the reluctant Bush responder hypothesis. I don't know why I offered up that name. I should have charged for it. Unfortunately, for that explanation, the response rates were highest in Bush strongholds. And in fact, there was basically no factual backing for that explanation at all. And it was literally the only benign explanation given for why there was this huge exit poll discrepancy. And the laws of statistics do not change at the U.S. border. These same exit polls were being used in the Ukraine to overturn an election, but not here. And what happened is eventually, I mean, the media dismissed the exit polls, and the debate became academic. And the bottom line is that once the debate becomes academic, we lose. America loses, democracy loses, because all that matters to the Karl Roves of the world is the bottom line, is winning. And the fact that we then have a two-year academic debate about different theories about the exit polls and whatnot doesn't matter a whit. In 2006, we had a bit of a better idea what to look for. We kind of, our learning curve, we were progressing along. And sure enough, there was another big, big fat exit poll discrepancy. And this time, the media came right out on election night and said, these exit polls are worthless. Well, Bob, they're off again. They oversampled Democrats. Problem was, we actually looked at the exit poll sample, and in every way, it was clear that not only had the exit polls not oversampled Democrats, they had, in fact, oversampled Republicans. It was very clear from the crosstabs. Any journalist could have done the same thing that we did. And those exit polls gave the Democrats in the House races 3 million more votes nationwide. And that was enough to turn about 20 to 30 seats. And enough to deny the landslide that the voters actually wanted to put into place. The American voters were very upset in 2006. And if the election had been a month earlier, because of the October free fall, if you remember Mark Foley and Haggard and Swaggart and Bob Woodward's book, the Republicans went into free fall in the month of October. If that election had been held a month earlier at the beginning of October before that free fall, the rig that was put in would have been sufficient to keep the House and the Senate in Republican hands. Problem is, you can't redeploy a rig with a magic wand on election day. These things have to be, at least as of that time, deployed at some point in real time, and they were miscalibrated. So the Democrats won, and everybody said, well, elections must be legitimate because the will of the people was respected. Baloney. There's more. There's whistleblowers galore. There's Clint Curtis, Chris Hood, Steve Heller, Steve Spoonamore, people who have come forth and said, this is what's going on. We have affidavits. From Clint Curtis, he went out and got, after his election was stolen, he went out and got affidavits individually, door to door, from the voters that said who they had voted for, made it very obvious that that election was stolen. And again, the beneficiary of that was Tom Feeney, who was the head of the Florida House of Representatives that basically was involved in the 2000 election and making sure that Bush was elected, quote-unquote, elected in 2000. So he came with these affidavits to the House Administration Committee, unanimously Republicans and Democrats, they said, can't look at these. Can't look at these affidavits. They might violate voter secrecy or some such garbage. So just evidence, as it turns up, is ignored and denied. And the other piece is there's a glitch pattern out there, things that go wrong, things that go bump in the night. And glitch patterns, you know, if they're random, they kind of break 50-50, especially when you have thousands and thousands. I pushed Kerry, I got Bush, I pushed Bush, I got Kerry, et cetera, et cetera. Well, these glitch patterns don't break 50-50. They break about 90-10, you know, in what direction. And so what we're thinking about the glitch patterns is that they're actually sort of programming errors that they misprogrammed so that things that were supposed to be covert and not disclosed actually showed up on the touchscreen. So there were thousands and thousands of reports of, I pushed Bush, I pushed Kerry, and I got Bush. And that was a programming error, as far as we can tell. It wasn't supposed to show up. So maybe there were glitches. After all, there were glitches in the programming of these machines. We have study after study, Princeton, Johns Hopkins, Brennan Center at NYU, that says these machines are absolutely vulnerable to all sorts of manipulation and fraud. And we have stakes that are higher than any other game in the world. $12 trillion economy, such as it is, the world's strongest military, and all the power anybody could ever aspire to. And we look at other games, Major League Baseball, Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens, NASCAR, the regulator plates, the Olympics, all sorts of things, the Tour de France, the NFL, the NBA, where the opportunity exists, the vulnerabilities are there, and there's no oversight. What happens? Manipulation, cheating. And yet we're sitting there and saying, we're going to believe that this biggest game of all is on the level in spite of the vulnerabilities. Why? Why? And that's the interesting question. What is it that we want to assume? That's what's interesting. American hubris. We are the beacon of democracy. We are not Pakistan, damn it. We're not Kenya. We're America. This doesn't happen here. That wall of denial is 400 feet high, and the closer you get to the echelons of power, the higher up in the elite pyramid you go, the higher that wall gets. And it is very disturbing to think it's happening here. I mean, just warm up to the idea that our elections are being stolen. It's very hard to do, even when you have the evidence. And what if it were exposed? Oh my God, the Dow, it's in enough trouble already. Our investments. Make no mistake, they counted on this. This is what they counted on. That the immune system of American democracy would not rise to the occasion. We were born into a democracy, all of us probably, or most of us here, born into it, that we thought we could take for granted. All the heavy lifting had been done decades and maybe centuries since. We could just enjoy the fruits, support this or that campaign or cause, vote every couple of years. So this is Constitution Day. And George Bush reportedly once referred to our Constitution as a scrap of paper. I think there might have been an expletive in there as well, but we'll let him off easy. A scrap of paper. And you know what? He's absolutely right. That's all it is. For all of its elegance, for all of its brilliant checks and balances, it can't defend itself. The Bush regime has shown that it can be violated with impunity, its safeguards progressively shredded, like the scrap of paper it is. But wait, we say, we'll fix all that at the next opportunity, the next election. We'll fix it with our votes. Go ahead and try. In America, 2008, I'm sorry to say, you are very likely to find that, as Stalin was said to have remarked, it's not the votes that count, it's who counts the votes. That's our predicament. That's what's happening to America in our lifetimes. The Constitution, lifeblood, central nervous system of America, it's in our hands. And I want all of us to ask ourselves whether anything, any task or errand, any board meeting, any term paper, any hot date, any soccer practice could possibly be more important. Thank you.
Our next guest is known by most of you already. He was there with Martin Luther King, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. He was there when Reverend King was assassinated. He held him. He founded the Rainbow Bush Coalition. Bush, I said, excuse me. Bush Coalition, pardon me, Reverend Jackson. And he ran for president in 1984 and 1988, building a coalition that Democrats built upon years to come after that. And wherever there's a social justice crisis in America, Reverend Jesse Jackson is there, and he's here with us tonight. Reverend Jackson.
Let me express my thanks and joy and delight for having this privilege to share with you on this occasion. I would urge you not to allow these voter-stealing schemes to break your spirit and take away your joy and make you cynical. For in spite of these schemes, we can win if we fight back with courage and we are not inclined to surrender. The roots of this battle go back as far as the Civil War. Tonight, you do not have the federal right to vote, or the state's right to vote. The 50 state separate and unequal elections. Every state has its own system. Within that state, the counties have their systems. We have a federal highway system, a federal controller system on for airplanes, but not the federal right to vote. Thus, it is not uniform. That is, in fact, a Civil War trade-off. And this idea of states' rights over federal protections, the idea of unregulated greed without checks and balances, the logical conclusion is the Wall Street meltdown, the lack of regulation and transparency and enforcement of laws. And so the book ends really is the Civil War trade-off and what's happening on Wall Street even as we meet here tonight. The reason I'm so inclined to be hopeful and optimistic in this battle that we must fight and we must win. When many see Barack is emerging in 2004, a brilliant race he has won and run. Barack is running the last lap of a 54-year race. He is running the anchor leg of that race. And you who are here tonight must put this fight in its context. This is not a generational struggle, young versus old, new versus old. This is an intergenerational struggle, intergenerational, that has continuity. And only by connecting to the continuity of our struggle can one appreciate where we are, what the possibilities are. We are a better nation today than we were 50 years ago. August 28, 1955, Emmett Till was lynched, kind of state-sanctioned terrorism. He was out of his place. August 28, 1963, Dr. King, 8 years from that date, dreaming of a new America beyond apartheid. The day he spoke in Washington, D.C. was under military lockdown. If a train that came in, a car that came through the highways, an airport was under lockdown for fear of a riot. That day he spoke from Texas across to Florida up to southern Maryland. We can use a single public toilet. toilet or facility. Our money was counterfeited. We could not buy ice cream at Howard Johnson. We could not rent a room with money at Holiday Inn. On the day he gave that speech, Nazi POWs had rights that African-American soldiers did not have on the same military basis. In spite of that, we've made great progress. And so you go from August 28th, 55, Emmett Till being lynched, August 28th, 63, Dr. King giving that great speech, to August 28th, 2008, Barack being nominated by the Democratic Party. Now, what has happened here in this process? The reason why you are now being born into a train that already left the track. 1954, a little girl, Linda Brown, from Barack's mother's home state, Kansas, was led by her father and by Thurgood Marshall from this city. They won a lawsuit to make race and, by extension, gender supremacy illegal. Because prior to that decision, blacks had no rights, whites were bound to respect by law, and surely women did not either. So the 54 decision redefined democracy and law. The 1955 boycott was a test case of the 54 law. We won the boycott in 55, we won the lawsuit in 56. The Little Rock Nine battle going to Little Rock Central High, the school of your choice, was a test case of the law. All of our civil rights sit-ins and marches were testing the new law. So by 1964, we got a new law of public accommodation so we could use these public facilities protected by the federal government. In 64, Fannie Lou Hamer, Atlantic City, New Jersey, Atlantic City Democratic Convention, held up the convention, held it up arguing that why should an all-white Democratic Party be seated in Mississippi, did not include all the Mississippians. After much struggle, the compromise, you can have two seats, but neither can be Fannie Lou Hamer. But she began to redirect us from this issue of freedom to political equality. It's about 65, you have the next upsurge, and in that struggle, we went to Selma in 65. Remember, women couldn't serve on juries. Blacks, Latinos couldn't vote. And farmers who couldn't pay poll taxes could not vote. As a matter of law, and those who tried to face the terror of being killed at the polls. And so Fannie Lou, Serena Goodman, Trainer, two Jews and a black were killed about the vote. Med gave us killed, terrorized in the struggle for the right to vote. Reverend James Reed killed in the struggle for the right to vote. This was the terror involved in tearing down that wall. By 1970, another breakthrough occurred. 18-year-olds got the right to vote. There was in some quarters at least as much fear about that vote as about blacks and women because there's so many teenagers and it's not up for blacks on the deal. But we argued if teenagers are old enough to fight in Vietnam, they're old enough to vote. And so we won that argument. That's extension of Selma, Alabama. By 74, we won another very significant law case, residency. That you, if you go to school where you are tonight, you don't have to vote absenteeism or go home. You can vote right where you live, right where you reside. That was a big deal because towns like Madison, Wisconsin, Ann Arbor, Michigan, the fear was that students, in fact, because they were marching and very political during that season, would use their voting numbers to begin to take over the governments of towns, whatever schools. That those students, in fact, would run for city council. And maybe only Ann Arbor and Madison did it. Most students receded back into the routineness of going to school, but the idea of residency took place. So we saw it this year where students in Iowa and other caucus states didn't have to vote absentee or go home. They could register and vote where they were in school, and then form caucus. Whole dormitories became caucuses. That was the big difference because you had the right to vote in that way. In 1975, something called bilingual. If your first language was Spanish or Native American, the Eastern European, as the case may be, you had the right to vote in that language, another extension of Selma, Alabama. The journey continues. We fought for redistricting and proportionality in the breakout of districts. In 84 and 88, when I first ran, it became apparent that apparent to us and clear that in something called winner-take-all, they had 40% thresholds before you could be a delegate. And if you won the state 51-49, you won all the delegates. And so somehow 49 did not equal 100, I mean did not equal 0, and 51 didn't equal 100. So we, in fact, in 88, changed the rules to proportionality. This year, if Hillary wins California, Texas, Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York, she's the winner, with the winner take all the rules back which the Republicans play tonight. But in our system, proportionality with a lower threat, the 15% threshold allowed more common people to become delegates. And it also allows us, in fact, to vote proportionality. And that's why we are a more democratic process. By 1990, by extension, the Physical Disabilities Act. So if you are blind and need to vote in Braille or you need wheelchair access, we won that battle. All these battles for the right to vote leads us to 2008. But you got to stop by 1972, where we had to unseat the day of the Democratic Convention delegation because they did not want to play by the rules, the McGovern rules of inclusion. Struggles all along the way. And so 2000, the Republicans determined that they could not win by registration. They could win by forms of elimination and forms of suppression. So in 2000, Ms. Harris used the rules of felons in Florida, in Texas, and imposed them in Florida. And people whose name was John R. or John S. the K. maybe, they used the felon's rolls to confuse and knock folk off the rolls. Students at Florida A&M and Bethune-Cookman who did vote were denied student access to voting. And so out of all that, Bush ends up winning by five and 12 votes. Lastly, 2008, the owner of the Diabo machine says Bush will be the winner. Secretary of State, who co-chaired this campaign, said Bush will be the winner. So you're going to play, the Ravens are going to play the Giants Sunday, and the owner who hires the referee said we're going to win. It's hard to lose or win a close game with those kind of regulatory schemes stacked against you. And so in Ohio that day, we had lines, long lines of wet people and dry machines. And thus, we lost the election. And so voting matters. Voter disenfranchisement schemes are alive today. Good news is, look where we've come from. Today you have a woman on the ticket, and you have an African-American heading the ticket because we've been fighting gender suppression and fighting for gender equality and racial justice all along that line. So Barack, in some sense, becomes the result of 54 years of legal struggles to democratize the process. You pick up that baton now, and on November 4th, you vote against all odds, and don't let us down. Thank you very much.
So before we have the audience discussion, and there are mics on this side of the room, which we'll get to shortly, we'll start up here, the panel discussion, then open up to the floor so you all can participate in this conversation with our guests. And I think we may make an assumption that's we shouldn't take at the moment, which is that the 2000 election, the 2004 election, was assumed by some to be rigged and stolen from the American people. But that was something, as I said in the beginning, that was pushed aside in the establishment media. It was poo-pooed as cranks and Democrats just angry because they lost and people who really have an axe to grind against the United States of America, which is why they're making these accusations. So I think just for our edification, just to go back for a little bit, to talk about that time and the things that some of you were saying then and others were saying about that election, and how that affects where we are in 2008. But I think it's important just not to belabor it forever. But let's just go back a little bit. Greg Palast, why don't you start off and to talk a bit about what happened in those elections and why people are arguing that these were potentially stolen elections.
Well, the Reverend to the good reprise of a story. I was in England in November of 2000. I report for BBC television because I can't report for U.S. television. So I'm watching BBC television, and African Americans are coming before the BBC television cameras, and at that time we allowed black people on camera who weren't criminals or basketball players, and BBC. And they were saying, we try to vote. We couldn't. My name was missing from the voter rolls. And I'm watching this in London. And I'm thinking that there's a, you know, sometimes I've been called a conspiracy nut by, like, Sean Hannity. And that always gets a laugh from the conspirators. So I'm thinking that there's, in my conspiracy nut mind, that there's some computer program which is identifying black voters and erasing their names from the voter rolls. And sure enough, I got two computer disks from Catherine Harris's office, which were the lists of voters who'd been expunged. And right next to their names, if you look at them, it says like Thomas Cooper, black. And you'd see the names, black, black, white, black, black, white, black, right there next to their names on the computer list. And we knew exactly who was being removed. And there was something very interesting. 54% of the names that were being removed, and there were 94,000 names, 54% that were being removed as felons, not allowed to vote, 54% were African Americans. But what was really interesting, when we went in and looked at those names, name after name after name after name, we found that they were guilty only of voting while black. I asked the Attorney General, if you found a felon voting, what would you do? And he said, I'd arrest them. I said, well, here's a list from Catherine Harris, 94,000 names. How many of you arrested? He says, we have 6 open cases. 94,000 names. It wasn't filled with, it didn't have some innocent people on it. There we are all, everyone innocent, and that was the presidency. And I could not report that on U.S. television, but I did put it on BBC television. The Reverend Jackson gave me airtime to bring it to the United States. It was not mentioned by one television station in the United States of America. It was the top of the nightly news and every other nation on the planet. Okay? You're not getting the story, and you're still not getting the story. What I've been telling you, I'm filming again for foreign broadcast. It's unconscionable. So to get it into America, I have to sneak it into a comic book. Steal back your vote. With Bobby Kennedy. Whatever it takes. Next we're going to do skywriting. We actually do have disco music. We have it all. Whatever it takes to get out the word. And what the Reverend said, and this is very important, don't let it discourage you. There's a good reason to vote, because they don't want you to. Okay? So that's important. And I'm not going to go through 2004, the same things, caging lists, the stuff we found, and that we're finding again. Okay? And I think what the Reverend's point is, first of all, it didn't start, the games with elections didn't start in 2000. I'm sorry. If 20% of America is banned by effective law from voting, we haven't had fair elections, almost never. Let's go back and think about this. This has been a fight. We are on a march. An African American at the top of a national ticket is another step in a long march. It ain't done. That's what this is about.
Reverend Jackson.
One of my concerns is that we see how interrelated we are and how intergenerational. If you're on the same Ravens football team and you are a Ravens fan, you cannot take lightly if a black guy gains 11 yards and gets credit for 9. Because the whole team loses. You cannot take lightly if a black guy gets into the end zone and it's rated a field goal and not a touchdown. You cannot culturally kind of take a hitch on, well, it's kind of their problem, because we're on the same team. It's us versus them. It's not skin color, it's uniform color. So when the black vote is stolen in Florida, then the whole Democratic ship goes down. I really say that because there was some almost cultural hesitation to really fight for the black vote in Florida, which was tied in everybody's destiny. The same is true with Ohio. And so in some real sense tonight, those who once fought to deny the vote and then change parties in reaction to the vote in the South and call themselves neocons and Republicans, those same forces have developed a scheme of voter suppression. And so they no longer deny the right to vote by blocking school doors and operating in vulgar ways, but formal, technical, and slick ways. So what does it mean when in the campaign where Kennedy wins by 112,000 votes, less than one vote per precinct, and the black district in Chicago, South Side, is credited with being the margin of difference? What does it mean when Dr. King is dead in 68 and Robert Kennedy is dead in 68, but the confusion how they targeted the black community for no-vote campaigns? They used gang bangers to intimidate the black vote. Two Blackstone Rangers were in their outfits in the balcony of the Congress when Nixon won in 68 because of don't vote scheme. Dr. King dead and Robert Kennedy dead and white people racist and Humphrey's a racist. So why vote? I mean, this verb, that's what happened. So here we are tonight. Of the 14 million registered black voters, according to the Joint Center for Political Studies, a slight over 6 million voted for Barack in the primary. That means 8 million didn't vote. And primaries are relatively low, so that will probably go up maybe to 10 plus million votes in the general election. But the 9 million blacks registered, eligible, who have not yet registered. So between the 9 million who are not registered and the 8 million who didn't vote, that's 17 million. The chancellor saw that pool of voters upon voting are likely to vote overwhelmingly in their interest, which is to vote for Barack. So that is, by definition, a targeted group. But that group's destiny and the rest of us is in the strength of the bound. That's the point. And so I say, gird your loins for the big fight, the fight to vote and the fight to have the vote counted. And I submit to you that we, at least when pulling down the walls, facing assassinations and who people were martyred, we tore down the walls. Some of us are bloodied and scarred because we were seen as militant and as aggressive. We tore down the wall. But today, you are in the bridge-building generation. But the bridge is built off of rocks that came from the wall that was torn down. That's why it is an intergenerational struggle. And that's why it's not new versus old. And that's why we all have a common interest in knowing this history and keeping it alive until we, in fact, make this a more perfect union. Thank you very much.
Jonathan, you want to add to that? Bring it in.
Something has been disturbing me. Well, a lot of things have been disturbing me. And one thing that's just come out that has been disturbing me is that I acknowledge the advances that have been made during certainly my lifetime. They are there. They're real. But I think of the two trains in a station, that illusion you get when both trains are moving and you think you're moving forward and you're really moving backwards. And I think of the Bob Dylan, "Something's going on here and you don't know what it is, do you, Mr. Jones?" And I'm very concerned with the appearance of advance, the first downs that you can get. Oh, we got a first down, that's great. Things are going well. When in fact the advances that have been made that the Reverend referred to have scared the liver out and irritated the hell out of a certain cadre of fascists. proto-would-be, whatever you want to call them, fascists who want power, who don't want the people to have power, and whose only concern is the bottom line, to hold power. Karl Rove put it right out there. American democracy has been based on this pendulum idea that you can hold the power today or you could hold power tomorrow, but not both. Think about it. Pendulum has swung. Karl Rove came out and said, our goal, I mean, you got to give him credit for putting it on the line. Our goal is perpetual power, a 40-year dynasty. And the only way you can get that is by grabbing the pendulum with your fist. And you cannot govern the way these people have been governing and hold power in a country like America perpetually. So something is wrong with the picture. And the idea that we have to prove down to the crossing of T's and dotting of I's that somehow election theft is taking place when it is so bloody obvious on so many fronts is big part of what's wrong with the picture, big part of what makes this Alice in Wonderland. In 2006, we wrote a paper called Landslide Denied. It is open and shut. The exit polls, there was a disparity. They didn't oversample Democrats. The laws of statistics hold in America. You can read it. It's on the Election Defense Alliance website. Very clear. We sent that paper out, and this is sort of parallel to Greg's experience, to 900 media outlets in this country. It was picked up by one, a small town paper in either North or South Dakota, memory fails, that put it on a back page. The media in this country, and for that you can read General Electric, Viacom, Murdoch, Disney, and Clear Channel, the big empires, the corporations, they can't touch this. And the people working for them can't touch this. And the people who try to touch this are sent abroad. Go talk to Al Jazeera. Go talk to the BBC. This is something very wrong with this picture because we have a woman on the ticket, for what it's worth. We have, for the first time, a person of color on the ticket. And yet, something is so ghastly wrong. And at some point later, I think we'll get to something else that's wrong about why outrage is being quelled. And I feel I've taken enough time with this. I just want to say that one of the things that Greg is trying to do is make election theft or make election protection entertaining. It's very hard to do because it's not a sexy subject. It's full of numbers and intricacies and, you know, programming and all that kind of stuff. And local election administration and all that. But we've also tried, and I just want to bring to your attention, there are a couple of films out there. One is called Stealing America Vote by Vote, and you can go get DVDs of that, StealingAmericaTheMovie.org. One is Uncounted by David Earnhardt, and they both speak to what Mark asked, which is what the hell happened in 2000, what happened in 2002, what happened in 2004 and 2006, and what's likely to happen in 2008. And I wouldn't say they're the most entertaining movies in the world. I don't usually see entertaining movies, so I wouldn't know what to compare them to. But they're rousing. You come out of there a little stunned and a little more than a little angry, and ready to act. And so it's worth trying to get your paws on either one of those. They're both strong films that really answer these questions of what's been happening with our elections. Thank you.
Let me move this into where we are right now. There's a question a lot of people's minds about this. I don't think we talked about it here yet, but we talked about it upstairs a little bit. There are, I think you said at Greg Palast, there are the largest group of voters being denied the vote in America, 6 million people, are ex-felons in this country. There are states that are consciously trying to not allow ex-felons to vote, discourage people to vote at best and not allow them at worst to vote. Michigan is trying to see people whose homes foreclosed upon don't have an address, so you can't vote. It's not the right address anymore. And so the question is, what do you do about it? What do you do about it in terms of the conscience of America to understand this? What do you do about it in terms of what you were saying, Reverend Jackson, with don't be discouraged, get out there and vote and fight for the vote? So the question is, A, who the hell do you think is doing this and why? And B, what do you do about it? What do we as a people do about it? Reverend Jackson, why don't you start off and then we'll go around the panel.
Well, you know, on a bad play the other night, San Diego lost a football game because the referee did not call the right play. But they didn't give up the next week. So part of my message is you cannot let these forces break your spirit, because whatever these technical schemes are today, you're not murdered for organizing a vote. You don't face the Sronda Goodman-Cheney option. You don't face Defendant Lou Hamer being locked out the convention option. And so the right to vote, democracy requires vigilance. And we've always had to fight for the right to vote. And now we have more with which to fight and really less danger. So don't convince yourself, well, maybe. Well, no, fight. You owe it to the right. And why do they want to steal your vote? Because it's valuable. Your vote will determine whether Wall Street has oversight, transparency and regulation, and laws enforced, or whether Wall Street can run amok and sink the ship, and those that did the sinking leap out with golden parachutes. That's an ideology. The deregulation is a point of view. Matter of fact, they tried to bring in Social Security and privatize it. Had we not won that battle politically, Social Security would be sinking tonight just like AIG. We won that battle. And so I think when I was a little younger, it seemed to me that we would say things like, I want my children one day to not have these battles to fight. I know better now. I want my children to have more tools with which to fight. The battle continues. That would be an eternal battle over the question of power. Those with the most will and most determination will win that battle. Don't let them break your spirit.
Amen. Greg, you raised the issue upstairs of the felons being denied the vote in this country. It's been a battle here in Maryland, fought for the right felons to vote in this state. So talk a bit about that nationally and what's going on.
Yeah.
And whatever else you'd like to grab hold of.
When I busted the story about how Catherine Harris called people who were guilty of voting while black felons who couldn't vote in Florida, there was a misimpression that felons can't vote. And here, let me tell you something. When he said, who's behind all this? Well, there's a group that was called the American Center for Voting Rights, nonpartisan, started by the Council for the Republican Party of New Mexico. So I went to him and said, what's this all about? Why do we have to change our laws? Because in 2002, we changed the law. George Bush signed the Help America Vote Act. And, you know, when Bush tells us he's going to help us vote, I get a little nervous. So I asked him, why do we need to change this vote? He says, because there's voter fraud. In fact, we had George Bush's appointee to the Federal Elections Commission, a guy named Hans Evans Bukowski, really, who said that 3% of the voter rolls, 5 million people are illegal aliens. They've swum across the Rio Grande to vote for Obama, right? 5 million. 5 million! And I said, wow, could you name five? He says, how do you do that? I said, well, if they register to vote, you have their name, their address. Why don't you arrest them? And in fact, I spoke to a U.S. prosecutor. He said, yeah, they gave me a name of 100 to go arrest. And I found among the 100, zero. And because he found zero, U.S. Prosecutor David Iglesias was fired.
Right.
At Karl Rove's demand. And at the demand of the guy that's screaming fraud. But I asked the man screaming fraud, well, give me the fraudulent voters. And he showed me a bunch. He gave me these lists. And he gave me this one in particular. I got this one from his list of fraudulent voters. Sheldon Bacina. Okay, I'll give you his name. Here's his link. He says, see this fraudulent voter. Went to the court. Obvious case of fraud. Because it's an ex-con, a felon. He shouldn't be voting in New Mexico. And we looked it up, and the Democrats said, you have nothing to worry about. Don't worry, we're not letting him vote. See, it's marked rejected on his form. But there is one thing that's a problem with this accusation about Sheldon Bacena. Felons can vote in New Mexico. Ex-cons can vote in 46 out of 50 states in the United States, but they are being denied the right to vote, and no one stands up for these citizens. I'm sorry, I don't believe, like the Soviet Union, we need millions of people with non-citizenship status. In 46 states, if you served your time, you can vote, and they stop you, and they stop you, and they stop you. So the first thing I want to say, if there should be a campaign, and by the way, something the Democratic Party doesn't like to talk about, 88% of ex-cons, doesn't matter whether you're black, white, rich, poor, whatever, you go to jail, you come out, and you vote Democratic. Okay? That is number one pool of unregistered Democrats in the United States are people who come out of prison. But no one is inviting them back into the community to vote.
It was sent them by Republicans, that's what it is.
And the other thing is, their sentences are Republicans, they come out as Democrats, but the thing is that, like, there was a Reverend Thomas Johnson of Gainesville, Florida, a friend of Jeb Bush, who was illegally denied the right to vote because he had served his time in New York, and then he was denied the right to vote in Florida, which they can't do because it's not they can't do that. Went to court, he won, the Reverend. And he finally went to register to vote. And they said, oh my God, you're a Republican! And he said, well, yes, he's African-American, ex-con, he's a Republican. And he said, well, if we had known you were a Republican, we wouldn't have given you a hard time. They actually said that. Okay. Now, it's what I'm telling you, it is not an accident. It is a concerted program to intimidate people out of the right to vote. And they're even getting the Obama forces, unfortunately, not to defend these people. Do not count on the political parties to defend your rights or the rights of your fellow citizens. That's what we do. So when they steal your vote, you go to stealbackyourvote.org and you hear the Reverend and Bobby Kennedy and me. And by the way, one thing, don't get upset by this, but we are making an entertaining film called Steal Back Your Vote, the movie. And it will be horribly entertaining because you'll get, you know, but we are out there talking to in New Mexico and other places with the disenfranchised voters and with the disenfranchisers themselves getting their story. It's entertaining only in the sense of, like, it's horrific and it's compelling, but it tells the story. So go back to stealbackyourvote.org and you'll soon be able to download the movie as well as the comic book. The important thing is download the list of the seven things you can do to protect your vote, including register if you have a felony conviction. You can and do that in 46 states legally. They will try to stop you. Make sure that you know the law, and if they do block you, let us know, please. We've got to bust
Greg, you're also, if you are in jail, you're not a convicted felon, you can vote from jail.
That's right.
If you're in jail and you are not a convicted felon, you still you vote until such time. And that's also a significant body of people.
May I?
Please do.
I always seem to go drift off to the what I like to think of as the big picture here. And I mean, I think one of the real shifts in paradigm, again, in American culture, political culture, is that for the longest time in America, you had constituent groups, you know, rich, poor, whatever, immigrant, native, that were represented at various levels of the, you know, the pyramid of the hierarchy by representatives, senators, whatever, that sort of would duke it out in their interest. And the very pernicious shift that we've seen, and it's pertinent to this, is that in America of 2008, the public has become the enemy. And this goes to why the Democrats are being so unhelpful, even in their own, what would seem to be their own interests. This is the information age, so-called, and knowledge is power. And if you look at it, you see that the elites, for whatever their reasons, are trying to find out as much as possible about me and you and you, and make sure we know as little as possible about them, including how our votes are counted, for instance, as well as all sorts of various things like energy policy and whatnot. While they're amassing databases about us, makes it very convenient if we ever actually get any traction as a people to start picking off the dissidents. And this is a terrifying thing on Constitution Day, absolutely terrifying. And, you know, we break bones bending over backwards to be nonpartisan so we can get our 501c3 and, you know, be reasonable. I mean, after all, this is a process issue. We wouldn't want Democrats to be stealing elections either, honestly. But we can't help it if the stench is coming from one corner of the room and keeps coming from that corner of the room. I mean, that's not our doing. We're not just looking in one corner of the room. We're looking in every corner. What we're finding in the Democratic corner is something that's either ignorance, apathy, stupidity, complicity. We're not sure. But we damn well know what we're finding in the Republican corner. And it really stinks. And, you know, it's ironic that I have a press release here, the McCain-Palin campaign. They've just launched their Honest and Open Election Committee. I give you the website. It's www.johnmccain.com/honest. And if you look at the composition of this committee, a Hans von Spakovsky doesn't happen to be on it, but he would be a very good candidate. It is wicked stacked. If you look at, you know, you can look at it on the website, I'm sure, and draw your own conclusions. And they have had the chutzpah to sort of come out and say that their goal is to make sure that there's transparency. And this idea that a transparent and open process in every voting place in the country, as if it could be transparent when computers are counting your votes and you can't see what's happening. Or computers are determining who's registered to vote and you can't see what's happening. But it's going to be transparent because they say so. And because, well, I don't know, maybe they'll allow an observer to watch the outside of the computer to see if it changes color or something. This is Orwellian, absolutely Orwellian. It's the McCain-Palin campaign. I mean, I'm sure you've formed opinions of how Sarah Palin's being marketed. That's also Orwellian. I mean, if you look at what's being done to our language, it transcends hypocrisy. If anybody has any suggestions afterwards, I've been looking for a word that goes beyond hypocrisy. I haven't yet found one.
Lipstick.
But that's what we're at. Thank you.
Lipstick, that's the word.
Thank you.
Ha, ha, ha.